all the way from Queens. Okay. Is that, we have a brief introduction to the Kuzari, why I'm interested in teaching the Kuzari, and some methodological background statements about the Kuzari, certain assumptions I'm going to make about the work, which will heavily influence the way in which I interpret it. The Kuzari purports to be the record of an actual historical event, right? But as Yehuda Levi says, that what I'm going to do is I'm going to write down the arguments presented by a certain chacham. I think it's supposed to be Rav Yitzchak Almangari, in a dialogue with the actual king of the Khazars. Right, and in that case, right, if you're treated that way, then we can't look for any kind of finesse or artistry or literary devices or anything like that, because after all, Yehuda Levi is just described writing down what he remembers. That's one possibility. Right, this is really just a transcript several hundred years later of what actually happened with the Khazars. We do know, right, that there actually were, there actually was some kind of dialogue which did lead to the conversion of some percentage of the Khazar nation, although what exactly happened historically is lost in the archaeological record. But that doesn't mean, of course, the fact that a real event happened doesn't mean that this is actually the record of that event. Right? So one could take the opposite approach. One could say that, in fact, Yehuda Levi is using that as a device, as a literary device, which gives him certain advantages. It lets him use a dialogue, first of all. A dialogue is a very useful device, not just because it keeps people's interests, but also because it lets you present ideas in certain ways which are interesting. In particular, both the dialogue and the claim that one is recording a historical event give you distance from the arguments, right? If someone disagrees with the argument, you can point to them and say, well, okay, I agree with you. That wasn't a very good argument. But I had to write it down because that's what happened. All right, so the use of the dialogue and the claim of historical event is a way of giving the author distance, right, from his own work. And I would claim that that's a device Yehuda Levi utilizes very well throughout the Kuzari. But I want to claim also that if one works on the assumption that the Kuzari is a historical fiction as opposed to a historical transcript, that makes one much more sensitive in general to literary devices. And I think I can show you in the introduction here that if one reads the Kuzari that way, as a deliberately composed philosophic dialogue, as opposed to as a transcript, that a lot of things that you wouldn't notice at first glance come out. What I want to do tonight is try and set forth what I think is the ultimate theory behind the entire Kuzari. I think it's contained in the introduction. I state openly that this is, so far as I know, a fairly idiosyncratic reading. So I hope that you'll pay close attention to see whether you agree with me or not. And I should say also that I set out to read the Kuzari with an agenda. That at one point in my life I was a very anti-Kuzari person. I found the book deeply objectionable for a number of reasons, one of which we can't get to tonight, which is I think also a common misunderstanding of his position about the uniqueness of the Jewish people, which I think is often radically misunderstood, but we can't do that tonight. But the specific reason that we're talking about tonight, the specific objection I had is that people tend to view the Kuzari as a book which at least believes itself to prove the truth of Judaism. Okay, and the fundamental argument the Kuzari makes for the truth of Judaism, which is fundamentally boils down to 600,000 people wouldn't lie, and 600,000 people couldn't be fooled, and nobody could make up a claim that 600,000 people saw something. Now, whether or not you think that's a good argument, okay, I certainly don't think it's a proof, although it has certain intuitive appeal. The question is, people tend to take that understanding of the Kuzari basically believes that any intelligent person would understand that Judaism is true, right, and that therefore, if you don't believe that, then you must be a fool, a charlatan, or worse. And I tend to think that that is a tremendously arrogant and basically untenable position. If one knows that extraordinarily bright people over the years have not believed in Judaism, I believe Judaism is true. But I think that a claim that one can prove it to the degree that anyone intelligent would realize it is really wildly arrogant. And attributing such an idea to the Kuzari, and very often people build such ideas off the Kuzari, tended to make me unfond of the work. So we'll see tonight. I think that the Kuzari says nothing of the sort. And in fact, we'll see that the Kuzari says takes a position about as extremely opposed to that as one can. Okay, that's to tip off where the thesis is going to go. So let me begin by reading the opening sentence. Okay, right? Kuzari said, Yehuda Halevi, the author, says, I was asked in my responses and objections to those philosophers and adherents of scriptures who disagree with us, as well as to the heretics who disagree with the mass of Israel, and I remembered this argument. Okay, right? Yehuda Halevi says he's going to respond to philosophers, adherents of other scriptures, namely Christians and Muslims, right? Hindus and that kind don't enter into the work. And the heretics among us who disagree with the mass of Israel. Anybody know who that refers to? Karaites. Okay, and in fact, we have a letter from Yehuda Halevi in which he tells us that the point of the Kuzari is to defend against Karaites. Okay, all very well and good. Now tell me, right, you read the whole introduction. Which characters appear in the introduction? Philosopher. Christian, Muslim, no Karaites. Okay, isn't that interesting? Right, in a work which he tells you explicitly here is partially supposed to respond to Karaites, which he tells us in a letter is mostly designed to respond to Karaites. We don't have a Karaite. Okay, that to me is a fundamental question that you have to right. If you can't answer that, right, you can't really understand the book. Right, why can't he have a Karaite there? Now it might be he can't have a Karaite there because there was no Karaite. Right. So if you take it as a historical work, this is no question at all. On the other hand, if you take it as a fiction, right, that becomes deeply significant. And I don't know what the historical record teaches us, that whether there's a Karaite there or not. What is interesting is that in the middle of the Kuzari, the Khazar king says to the Khaver, and you know what, I see that those Karaites are much more faithful to their religion than you are. Right. So the Khazar king knows that there are Karaites. But for some reason he never feels compelled to call them in. Okay, so I think that's a significant point. I should say that Leo Strauss, the great University of Chicago philosopher, argued that an even more significant in the work is the idea that the philosopher gets dismissed early. Right, because he sees the book as fundamentally an attack on philosophy, and his argument is that the philosopher cannot be allowed to speak for himself with any degree of seriousness because philosophy is too seductive. And if you let the philosopher talk for himself, he would win. And his evidence for that, though, right, is that you'll find throughout the book, every once in a while, the Khazar king jumps on the philosophic bandwagon as if the philosopher were there. Okay, and there's evidence of that in the introduction, right? Because when the Khazar king responds to the philosopher, right, what does he say to him? He says, you know, your arguments are very good and nice, right? But they don't work for me because I had a dream. When he turns to the Muslim, he says, but look at me, I don't believe, right? If I don't believe that God speaks to human beings, how are your arguments going to convince me? And basically, he quotes the philosopher at the Muslim. Okay, right? If you see throughout the rest of the introduction, you'll see the Khazar king basically bought all the philosopher's arguments. Except he had a dream. That's going to be important too. I don't accept Strauss's argument that the philosopher isn't allowed to talk to himself for himself because he's too dangerous, and that the whole work is about that. But I think if you study the introduction, you study the way in which the Khazar king adopts the philosopher's arguments, and that tells you something also. Okay. Now I want to point out a couple of other things in the introduction. Particularly, I want to discuss the way in which the king reacts to the philosopher's arguments. This is a very personal way of showing what goes on between the king and the philosopher. The king tells the philosopher what, right? What drove me to this? What drove me to this? Why am I seeking everyone out? Because I had a dream. Good. Let's take a look at the end of what the philosopher says to the king. Okay, if you take a look at the end, that's on the second. It's the end of the first page, right? Yeah, it's on the bottom, the first page, right? The underlined section. Right, the philosopher tells him, right, seek purity of heart. Perhaps it will, right, because if you attach yourself to the active intellect, the philosophic ideal, perhaps it will imbue you with prophecy and inform you of the future in true dreams. Okay? Right, so the king says to the philosopher, I had a dream. The ending of the philosopher's speech is, well, if you do what I say, then you'll have true dreams. Okay, how did the philosopher start? He started by saying, you know what, your dream is false. Right, because what's driving the king is, I have a dream which he says, if an angel comes to him and says, your intentions are pleasing, are desirable to God, but your actions are not. The first thing philosopher says to him is that God is above knowledge of particulars, so he doesn't know that you exist, let alone your intentions and actions. Okay, so the first thing the philosopher does is head-on attack him. Okay, and then to add insult to injury, right, he says, well, your dream is false, the reason you came to me is false. If you followed my tactic, right, then you would have true dreams. To which the king's response is, right, and this is on the second page, right, the king's final response is, right, according to you, right, this is section number 4, it would be appropriate that in accordance with the deeds of the philosophers, with their actions, fidelity to truth and strivings, we would find prophecy known and found among them because of their attachment to the spiritual, and that stories of great wonders would be told about them. Instead, we see that true dreams come to those who have engaged neither in wisdom nor in purification of the soul, and false dreams in those who have so engaged. Right? The king says, you claim that I'd have true dreams if I followed you? You guys have false dreams all the time. Okay. What that tells you is that fundamentally, the philosopher has no chance of convincing the king. Okay? The dialogue is set up so that the philosopher, right, the philosopher begins, right, the philosopher were, if we wanted to have a fair chance, right, so the philosopher would say, oh, great and wise king, who has achieved wisdom through the dream, let me explain to you what it is that your dream meant and how it is you can attain the action which is pleasing to God. Right, having flattered him for 10 minutes, he would then start slowly to introduce him to the truth of philosophy. Instead, the philosopher's opening sentence makes it clear that he and the king are not going to communicate. Okay, and at the end he gets personal. Right? At the end of which it's entirely clear the king's reaction to him is not at all based on his arguments. The king just hates his guts. Alright, so now the question is, however, right, if the point of this dialogue is to convince us, right, that in fact Judaism is superior to philosophy, right, so then it should be a fair fight, right? The king should look at a serious presentation of philosophy, look at a serious presentation of Judaism, and say, aha, Judaism wins. But he doesn't. Right, so what's the point of the argument? Right, what's the point of presenting the philosopher this way if he doesn't get a fair chance? Okay, that's right. That I think is also a central issue in understanding the nature of the Kuzari. But it gets worse. Yes.
As far as the story is concerned,
yeah,
it's true he does not get a fair chance.
Right.
But the underpinnings of the philosophy does come across and is judged. It's that what's going on is that the philosopher is saying that God is not really, that we are not relevant to God. And the king's response is, I'm sorry, I believe that we are.
Well, the king's response is, I'm sorry, I had a dream. The philosopher tells him, your dream is false. What evidence does the king have that's not true? How does the king know that his dream is true?
How does the king know?
Well, yeah.
Again, from a literary standpoint, you're right. You don't know.
As from, we stand here. Okay, right? This book is supposed to convince me. I don't have a dream.
Right.
I have a philosopher demonstrating to me that God does not know particulars, and someone who has no credentials at all, right, claiming that he had a dream. Who should win? That's the case. That's true, but we have no grounds for rejecting philosophy based on this book. So the rejection of philosophy is a sham.
You're not going to necessarily be able to...
It gets worse. All right. Well, hold on one sec. Let me explain why it gets worse. It gets worse because not only does the king reject the philosopher for bad reasons, he doesn't even understand the philosopher. Right? It's very clear if you read it, the king completely misunderstands the philosopher. Okay, what's the philosopher's argument? The philosopher's argument to the king is, you know what? It doesn't really matter which religion you choose, so long as you intend to purify your soul. Right, and if you intend to purify your soul, and you, right, then there are any number of strains of action which will allow you to perfect your body so as to perfect your soul. Okay, so the philosopher is a pluralist in that regard. Right, he says you can make up your own religion. Right, or pick any of the philosophic religions. Right, which would include Christianity and Islam, by the way. Right, because he thinks that, right, because he'll claim that, because all philosophers will claim that the founders of all religions are philosophers. Okay, the king takes that to mean that all that matters is your intention. It doesn't matter what you do. Now, that's completely false. The philosopher doesn't claim that it doesn't matter what you do. The philosopher doesn't claim, go out and kill as many people as you want, so long as it's for the sake of religion. No. The philosopher says that when you understand what the purpose is, there are any number of ways in which you can achieve that purpose. Right? And the king purports to reject the philosopher and say, you're wrong, because if you were right, because if... Because if you were right, how could there be two conflicting forms of religion? Ridiculous. Right, ridiculous. The king's objection to the philosopher is, what's going if there isn't an intrinsically desirable course of action, right? What do you say to Christianity and Islam, who have divided the populated world between them? Right, they each have the right intent, and yet they still kill each other. They can't both be right. Okay, they can't both be right. And the philosopher looks at the king and says, "I don't understand. What are you talking about? Right, I believe that any religion that a religion has to be intended to perfect you, and a religion which involves killing other people who are trying to perfect themselves is wrong." I never said, says the philosopher, that any action you do is right as long as you have the right intent. I said that there's no specific action which is necessary. Right, so right, any action which fulfills that intent is sufficient. Okay, so the problem is, right, summing up, the king's rejection of the philosopher is clearly unserious in the sense that it's personal as opposed to argumentative, and secondly, it's right, the philosopher doesn't even get a fair chance to present his argument to the king because the king doesn't even understand it. Now, why does Yehuda Levi present a protagonist who misunderstands the argument and isn't even willing to engage in it seriously? Yes, y'all. Let me point out, it's not just the philosopher who gets dismissed this way. Okay, the Muslim comes in, right? And the Muslim says, right, this is a big argument in Islam in the Middle Ages. The Muslim says, hey, look, the Quran, that's a really beautiful book. The Quran proves its own truth. Because there's no way a human being could write a book as beautiful as the Quran. And by the way, this is a big fight, right? Because a lot of medieval Jewish poetry comes out of the desire to prove that you can write just as beautifully in Hebrew as in Arabic. Right, which there's really a lot of, even in the secular Spanish Jewish poetry, there's a religious point to it. The religious point is to prove you can do anything in Hebrew that they could do in Arabic. And if you failed, you claimed it's because we lost most of biblical Hebrew anyway. Oh yeah, I don't read Arabic. I read Arabic. Now, what kind of argument is that? How is that supposed to present me? I can read, what do I do if I read Arabic? Right, it means that as bad as the king is with the philosopher, the Muslim's worse. Right, because he doesn't get it at all. Okay, yes, Miles.
Is that argument though saying that if it was true, then it would be universal knowledge?
Why? It's only universal knowledge if you read Arabic. How could it be true? How could it be universal knowledge if you don't read Arabic?
If it would be true, then it would be something that everyone should understand.
Why? There are lots of true things you don't understand. It happens to be true, let's say, right, that the idea of order at Key West is the most beautiful poem ever written in the English language. The idea, it's a poem by Wallace Stevens. It's a beautiful, beautiful poem. I think it's the most beautiful poem written in the English language. Now, how is, right, suppose you only speak Arabic. How are you going to know? It's true.
Right, so then that poem has a limited meaning to the rest of the world.
So?
Well, he might think if you may be supposing that the truth should be...
Well, we'll get there. Hold on, that's important, but it needs to be sharpened from there. Yes, Ben?
Perchance... You could
maybe that the king is not only someone who doesn't know Arabic, but he also has a 10-year. Right? So it might be that he's really stacking the deck. Right? You might be right. I don't know. I've never heard the Quran. But it might be that he's stacking the deck by creating a...
You want
a
reading?
No. That's
fine. Right. He also charms the idea of beauty as being
Right? And if he takes it seriously, right? How can he do that? Yes, I'll end up for a long time. I agree. That's the problem we're dealing with, right? He doesn't understand the philosopher. He can't understand the Muslim.
He can't understand anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. What if the king feels that
God speaks to human beings?
Yes, but he wants to know what is beyond that. He's looking for a sign, and the Muslim appreciates this, and he says Muhammad did perform many wonders. It's just that you have to understand that's not our big proof that we use.
Right. Fundamentally, right. What the king says to the Muslim is, what would you say to the philosopher? Right?
Okay.
Right? And the king himself had nothing to say to the philosopher, but he rejects the Muslim on the grounds that he wouldn't have anything to say either.
Well, he wants... It looks to me, especially from the Muslim's remark, from his retorts...
Okay, yes, y'all.
No, the point is that,
they're just literary devices to get you to the Jew. Right? And then introduction doesn't really have any meaning at all. It's just an excuse to get to the Jew.
Philosopher still has meaning.
Philosopher still has meaning. Okay, I think they all do, but I'll try and prove it. I understand why you think that, but let's see if I convince you at the end. Yes, Miriam? Take a look at the Christian. Okay? So the Christian is the response of the Christian, first of all, you should understand the presentation of the Christian is a wonderfully designed thing. Because the Christian gets up and he presents an excellent it's an excellent presentation of Christian doctrine, which has no appeal whatsoever for anybody. Right? Because you understand that Christianity never wins because people say that, wow, that makes sense. Right? No, right? Of all the many successes Christianity has had, that's not one of the reasons. The thing that appeals about Christianity is the concept of grace. Right? It's right, the notion that your sins get forgiven. That's the only thing, that's what Christianity's appeal is based on. The Christian never gets to present that. So that's just one interesting thing, right? You know, any Christian presenting his doctrine would start off with that.
That's an emotional hook, and over here, this is...
Okay, so we can argue that like the philosopher, right, the philosopher gets presented as this dry, right, as this dry intellectual, and so does the Christian. Even though we understand that philosophers, okay, maybe it's a fair stereotype, but Christians, unless you happen to get a scholastic, right, Christians on the whole start by talking about things that work. Right, Christians are good at Kirov.
If this is supposed to be a document which is supposed to show what reality would be, and it's based on logic, then it's really no place to put in an emotional hook, such as, well, you can have grace and you can have all your sins forgiven.
The Jew gets presented a whole lot.
The Christian and the Muslim, he says, what you're saying sounds nice, but there's no reason I should believe it if it goes against merit.
Okay, what I want to show is, right, let me make it sharper. What the king says to the philosopher is, you know what? Your words are convincing, right? Rationally, you make perfect sense, but I had a dream. What he says to the Christian is, right, what you're saying is a dream, but if I had your dream, I would believe in it. Okay, right, if we take a look at the king's response, right? Right, so let's start. Take a look first at 2. So the king's response to the philosopher is, I see your words as internally sufficient, meaning, right, what you say makes sense in its own terms, but is insufficient to answer my question because I know that my soul is pure and my deeds are directed. Okay, so your argument makes perfect sense, it just doesn't conform to my experience. When it comes to the Christian, that's section number 6, right, so the king says, there's no place here for reason. Reason regards most of what you've said as unlikely, but were it demonstrated by evidence and experiment to the point that no heart could avoid believing in it, reason would overcome the difficulties and gradually accept its likelihood as the scientists do the natural wondrous forces they see. He's talking, by the way, about magnetism. Right, understand, magnetism is impossible, right? And magnetism is the medieval equivalent of spooky action at a distance. Right, because right, how do things affect each other? Right, you know, this is over here, that's over there. How did this happen? Right, because in the Aristotelian world, all forces transmitted by physical contact. Right, so the same way that Einstein objects to quantum mechanics. Right, that's why I got the phrase spooky action at distance. Right, so all the medievals object to magnetism on those grounds. Right, magnetism is impossible. They didn't know about gravity as such. Right, they didn't know, right? Gravity was a function of different densities. That was fine. It wasn't the force, right, in the same way. As a natural attractive power of things towards their elements. Gravity didn't have a problem with. Magnetism was a big, big problem. My friend, Rabbi David Horowitz, who's Rosh Hashiva and YU, wrote his master's on magnetism in the Rashba. It's a big, big problem for Rishonim and lots of other people. That's what he means. By scientists see these wondrous natural forces, right? And if you put it, train a scientist in a room, always got his Aristotle, lock him in a room until he's 50, take him out, show a magnet, whoa, right? So the first thing that this philosopher will do is say, it's an optical illusion, right? The second thing he'll say, right, is I'm drunk, right? Right? Finally, but he says, look, if you give him enough time, he'll find a way to rationalize it. Okay, he'll invent magnetrons or something like that, right? Little invisible particles that go out, right? That go out from this thing to that thing.
That's how it works.
Yeah. Right. Well. Yeah. As we said. Yeah, I forget what exactly they call them. But any case. Okay. Well, the whole question, Aristotelians don't have forces, right? So it's not so clear we do anymore either, right? It's a big issue whether we have forces without particles.
It's all particle-based.
Right, that's the whole cool thing nowadays, right? There's no forces without particles again. We're almost Aristotelians again. Right. Okay, any case. The key point that comes out of the rejection of the Christian, right, is that, right, this is why it's central to the whole book, is that he tells you that reason cannot prove anything. Because he says, right, fundamentally his argument is, there is nothing I've ever heard as ridiculous as Christianity.
Right? This doesn't make any sense at all. But he says, I'm not saying that you're wrong to believe in it. Because if you have a Christian religious experience, so I know that reason can rationalize any powerful experience. Right? And so if you have a dream, right, in which a shining woman in white appears to you, right, and right, and says, right, and says X, Y, and Z, so okay. All right, that's very powerful, right? Because in a book, if the book were supposed to prove to you the truth of Judaism, right, how can you make a concession like this? How can you concede to you, number one, that reason never really proves anything? And number two, I'm telling you that I have nothing to say to a believing Christian. Right? Because that's what he says. I have nothing to say to a believing Christian. Because if you, right, because if you have a powerful Christian experience, an experience in which you believe as deeply as I believe in my dream, there's nothing I can say to you. Yes?
Just as a quick...
What it comes down to is that fundamentally, it looks like the king is unjustified in his rejection of each of the of his opponents. When it comes to the Jew, okay, and we don't have time to do a full presentation of the Jew tonight, right, the Jew's argument is really fascinating in its own right, but just to go through it rapidly, what he ends up saying, the Jew starts off by saying, I believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The king says, wrong, you're supposed to believe in the Creator. Right, that's what everyone else said to me. And the Jew gives him this whole fancy mashal, right, and again, I'd be happy at some other point to talk about all the flaws in the mashal, but let's take the mashal as given for now. And the point of the mashal is, right, is that you have to believe in God the same way you would believe in any king whom you had personal evidence, right, because he sent you a message. He sent you a message, right, and you got personal benefits. Right, and he says, therefore, the reason I start with Yitzhak Mitzrayim and not with creation is because what binds me to the Torah is God taking me out of Egypt. Right, because that's the equivalent of the king of India sending me specific messages.
And also the Khazar's dream.
Sure, we'll get to why the Khazar is a dream in a moment. Okay, the king says to him, that's the climax of the whole book, right, the whole introduction. The king says to him, if that's so, then your Torah is binding only on you. To which his response is, yeah. Okay, I want to argue that that's the whole point of the introduction. Namely, as follows. The advantage, right, and this goes, the title of the work of the series is The Disadvantages of Reason. The title of tonight's year is Less is More, all become clear now. The king says, look, philosophy, Islam, and Christianity all make universal claims. Okay, if you study the presentations of each of them, they all claim to be binding on everybody. So, the argument of the Khuzari is, anybody who makes a universal claim has to have universally accessible evidence. Because the assumption of the book is that it wouldn't be fair to condemn people to eternal punishment or non-existence, right, if they don't have a fair chance. Okay? So he looks at the philosopher is rejected because his argument, precisely because he can't convince the king. If you can't convince me, and you claim to be a universally true religion, then you're not. Okay? The Muslim and the Christian both claim to bind all human beings. Okay? If they claim to bind all human beings, then in order to be fair, they have to have an argument which convinces all human beings. But they don't. Because the Christian has an argument which doesn't work for anybody who doesn't have a Christian experience, and the Muslim doesn't have an argument for anyone who can't read Arabic. Okay? So what he says is fundamentally your arguments might be very good, but the very fact that they don't convince me proves that they're not true in your own terms. They might be true, right? They might be true points, but they can't serve as the proof of a religion which claims to be universal. Because a religion which claims to be universal has to be universal evidence. What makes Judaism unique is not that Judaism has better evidence, but that Judaism makes a smaller claim. Okay? Right, Judaism doesn't have any rational arguments better than the philosopher. It doesn't have any aesthetic arguments better than the Muslim. Okay, it doesn't have Christianity is stuck in the middle. Judaism doesn't necessarily do anything better than that. But what Judaism does say is, I claim that the only person who has to listen to me are people who have the historical experience of the Jews. Okay, the only jump he makes is he thinks that if you're part of a tradition, then it's as if you had the experience yourself. Meaning that all Jews have the Khazar's dream. Okay, so the ultimate argument of the Khuzari is I'm not talking to anybody who doesn't have a Jewish experience, right, who doesn't have access to the Jewish tradition such that, right, they would feel themselves, right, as part of that tradition as if they had the experience at Sinai. Okay? But to anyone who does, right, so experience, he pulls all the way through. Experience is the most powerful proof.
And we assume that the Khazar dream happens to jive with Jewish experience.
All right, now it happens, right, it happens that when it comes to the Khazar, right, that the Khazar comes to Judaism because, right, everyone else the Khazar can reject because everyone else makes a universal claim. Judaism is the first person who makes a claim the Khazar could accept.
That was
a default. That was a default. Ah, so now you understand why he can't have a Karaite. Because the Karaite could make the exact same arguments. Right? Nothing he says in the introduction would have the slightest impact on the Karaite argument. So, right, so if you understand, you're already setting up the introduction. Right? So the introduction is that in principle, the only argument is experience. Okay, that suffices to get you, right, to get you out of philosophy, Christianity, Islam. But Karaites, there is no basis for choosing between Rabbinism and Karaism, except if you have enough of a Jewish experience that you end up buying into the Rabbinic experience. Okay, so my claim is the introduction serves to tell you fundamentally that proof is irrelevant to religion. Right, so the assumption of the Khuzari is that reason can never overcome experience. Right, and the introduction just gets you out of all the other religions, right, and the rest of the book is where you have to respond to Karaism. All right. Yes, Yo. He doesn't deal with it. My bet would be that he would claim the Sheva Mitzvot are in fact rationally derivable, and therefore it's fair to make them universally, right? Since they are universal, he would argue that they are universally apprehensible, and therefore it's fair for Judaism to impose them. That seems to me the easiest way around that problem. I don't think, as I haven't been through the whole book in a long time, but I don't think he addresses it explicitly. That would be the simple way out. Yes, no. To this point.
Fine. He can play around with the rest of the book or what have you.
Yeah, sure.
Or even if he gets rid of the rest of the book, he has a general thesis that might
help the book, that there never really is a direct response to Karaism. I think that's a really interesting claim, and that has to be explored further. I think that I know why he's not here. Okay, how he gets response from the rest of the book, that's I haven't worked it out. It's not the part of the book I've done well. Yes, Ellie.
The answer to both the Christian and the Muslim.
He gives no evidence either. But he's not going to, right? What he doesn't say, right? What he says to the Christian is, I know that your argument is false because you claim universality.
Wait, but I'm saying, he's asking more than just that your argument can be possible. He's saying, in order for me to overcome the objections of my own intuitive reason, I have to know, right? The same way the argument with magnetism. Once I see the magnetism, I can try.
Right, but
the Jew is not showing him magnetism.
No, the thing, let's start with, he knows, right, he has already seen that God speaks to human beings directly. Because he has a dream. Right, so he knows that. The Jew does, right, the Jews don't make any claim more implausible than that. That's the only implausible claim the Jews make.
You're in the hoping to deduct the illumination, right?
It's illumination, but it's not, understand that he's telling you that if I were a philosopher, right, who never had a dream, then the Jewish argument would be just as bad as a Christian. But I'm not a philosopher, I had a dream.
But his main objection to all the religions is that they don't allow him to believe because of his rational...
No, listen again. They don't allow because they make rational claims for which... They make counter-rational claims for which he has no experience. But Judaism makes no counter-rational claim for which he has no experience, because the only counter-rational claim Judaism makes is that God speaks to human beings, and for that he has experience.
Whereas the others prove themselves false, and Judaism doesn't prove itself.
And more than that, the others make claims which don't make sense to him and which he has no basis for believing. Judaism makes only one claim which he believes is unreasonable, and for that claim he has an experience.
He
has a dream.
He has an experience of Yitzhak.
He doesn't need the experience of Yitzhak. Yitzhak Mitzrayim is proven, right? If you're Jewish, the Jew says, look, the Jew says, this is why I believe in Judaism. Now the Khazar, right, the Khazar has no reason to believe in Judaism at this point. But he knows he can't believe in Christianity and Islam. Right? He can't do philosophy. Judaism is not counter-rational to him, because Judaism makes no claims which make no sense to him.
Fine, but his dream has no connection to Judaism.
That's true, his dream. Even again, all he wants is something that doesn't not make sense.
Fine, that doesn't make sense, though.
It doesn't have to make sense. It just has to not make sense.
No, every time you keep saying that. Look, I want to believe it. I want to believe what you're saying is true. I have this problem. I can't bring myself to believe it because reason is not known to
them. No, but again, listen again. The reason isn't known to the Christianity because Christianity claims the Trinity, which makes no sense, and incarnation, which makes no sense. Judaism only makes one counter-philosophic claim, revelation. And for that, it doesn't matter what his reason thinks because he has the dream. That's why the Khazar has to have a dream. You understand, right? The whole book is biased, right? Because it doesn't work for people who don't have a dream, right? So why is it doesn't work for standard non-Jews? But the Khazar has to have a dream because the book's written for Jews. And if the Khazar doesn't have a dream, then he's not like Jews.
Any other people that just claims that minimalist counter-rational revelation coming in next week, he could also go over to...
That's true. If any other, or a Karaite.
Anybody else.
But it happens to be that in the real world, there were no religions that made narrow claims.
What about Baha'i?
Baha'i doesn't exist till the late 19th century.
Fine.
Early 20th century.
Well, it is.
He wrote the book then.
Well, it is in theory today. It doesn't work for all times, you're saying?
No, it doesn't work for all times, except it's a really powerful presentation of the role of proof in religion. He tells you fundamentally, right, that's for the Khazar. It doesn't work for anyone but the Khazar.
Fine, so
but for Jews, it works for all time.
Fine, no, if you want to say for all religions, which are similar to Judaism, in those aspects, it works for all time. That's fine.
Right.
But it says nothing about Judaism.
It works for Jews, for Judaism, for all time. That's all he wants. It's not a book about conversion.
Right.
It's a book for Jews. Right? This argument works for Jews. What it doesn't work for is for Jews who are raised as Christians.
But he's making it work for a Khazar, not a Jew.
Right. That's the whole. One of the things you have to work out next, right, is that why he makes it work for a Khazar and not just present the failing Jew. But the answer is because he couldn't persuade a Jew who had any doubts about the truth of Christianity as opposed to Judaism, he'd have no argument against them. Right. So he has to use the Khazar because the Khazar is the only person who would actually consider Christianity and Islam without having Christian Islamic experiences.
He says for every Jew, the historical experience is the tradition that you
receive. Right. But what happens if you have other experiences?
It's a problem then.
Right. But so the book is set up.
It only works for somebody who is A, not Jewish. B.
No, it works for somebody who's Jewish and has a Jewish experience and wants to feel okay believing in it despite philosophy.
Have a Jewish experience. It works for somebody who has an experience, Jewish pop. Possibly Jewish, possibly not Jewish, and doesn't have an experience that negates Judaism.
Right, that's what it works for.
It's a very narrow segment.
I don't know. I would argue that in his time, and even nowadays, it probably works for 96% of the Jewish population. Okay. Oh, you only had his hand up for a long time.
What about his response to Muslims and Christians? Would he say there's any room to condemn Muslims?
No. No. Why should he? As long as they keep Shabbat mitzvahs. Reich, why should he? Right? It's the whole thing, right? If I'm right. Right? It's fundamentally telling you it's okay to be Christian, it's okay to be Islamic, as long as you're not Jewish.
But you have to read into this, that the Shabbat mitzvot are somehow derivable.
Yeah. Or at some level, whatever he requires for non-Jews is derivable.
Uh-huh.
Right? But he tells you explicitly, our Torah is only binding on us. Right? So why should he condemn other people?
Okay.
Right? That's why I think it's a very modern book in that way. Right, as opposed to it's usually taken as an anti-modern book, right? Because of, you know, because it presents this proof from historical experience. But the point is, he only thinks that works for Jews. Okay, all right. I hadn't called. I think he would argue that it's unreasonable to expect the entire the entire world to have Arabic. Or he might even argue more strongly that a lot of people have never heard of the Quran. Right, and the problem is always the problem of the Christian claim, right? But he extends it to the Muslim claim, although it's not clear that's fair to Islam. Is right if you claim that you need to right, that if you're not saved, you go to hell, right? So what do you do with the children who die or the children who die in darkest Africa, right? That's basically what he's saying, right? Either because I don't know the language, or because there's no copy of the book available, right? Or because I'm not literate, period, right? There's a whole class of people who will never have access to the Quran. And you know, it's just fun to present it as I don't know Arabic, right? But the point is not I don't know Arabic. The point is there are people whom you couldn't convince, so your argument is wrong. Okay. Yes.
Just a quick question.
Logically, he shouldn't. He shouldn't follow this dream.
Yeah.
Right. That's a question of how seriously you take halachic frameworks for narratives. Right.
The
Rei Chalamot, yeah.
Well, presumably, if God's speaking to you, it falls under some category of Nevuah.
It's an angel.
Very adamant. Fine, so God speaks through angels, what have you. You can always, you know.
Maybe. I don't know. There's some people who want to argue that at the end, that the really radical reading is at the end the king agrees the philosopher was right, that in fact his original dream was false, but that he arrives at the truth of Judaism anyway. I think that's right, but I think that's a little too fancy.
Yeah.
You could argue that people who have these kinds of dreams are...
You could. That doesn't make it so useful. I think it's very cool that a book which fundamentally argues for the impossibility of conversion without, right, without supernatural experience, right, and is addressed to a convert. I think it's a cool phenomenon that he pulls that off. But in any case, just, you know, sum up, and then we should send people home. If you want to stay in shmooze with me, that's great. The sum up, for me, the important thing is that the Khazari fundamentally is really a very modern work in that it rejects the, right, the whole thesis of the introduction is the insufficiency of reason, right, the irrelevance of proof, and fundamentally, right, the argument that in religious matters you can only convince people who are already convinced. But there's a value to that, right? Because lots of people, right, who are right, who have the sufficient experience that they should really be convinced themselves, doubt their own experience. Right? And the goal of religious argument is to confirm people in their own Jewish experience. Okay, thank you. You've been a great audience as ever.